I want to see the team have the kind of fight that they had in 2016, even if we shocked the world!
Playing a Mexican team in the next round.
That's what I was about to say.
Powered it forward, Jack Price in goal!
And the Colorado Rapids, the team from the Rockies, have scaled their own mountain tonight. They are MLS Cup winners.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to another episode of Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We are recording this on Monday, July 3rd. Rabbi Mark Goodman, we are living in a world in which the Colorado Rapids have gotten results in three straight games. England apparently knows how to win in PKs, and LeBron James is a member of the Los Angeles Lakers. How are you making sense of the continually expanding, bizarre world that is 2018 in soccer and the world by extension?
I always love the notion that we went off on some sort of alternate universe tangent at some point. And the question being, what was the instigator for this alternative world tangent? What set us off? Did, like, somebody decide to put, the knife that they only use for peanut butter into the jam and then spread it onto the, like, you know what I mean? Like, was it an individual simple act that one of you listeners committed where you broke the norms of reality? Like, you threaded a bolt onto a nut, like, backwards and it worked, or, you know, you decided to skip leg day and do double arm day. Like, did somebody skew this, or was this just the natural result of events when the whole country votes for president? The guy doesn't get a majority of the popular vote, but wins the electoral. Is it a cosmic event, or is it a minor event that set us off on this tangent where England wins on penalties? I don't know, man.
I think it's clearly some event where there was a bunch of candy in the office and somebody decided to mix together a bowl of M&Ms and a bowl of Skittles and not tell anybody.
That's evil.
Yeah,
that's,
I know. Some men just want to watch the world burn, and some of them actively want to participate.
Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Yes.
It's good stuff.
Okay, Mark, let's get into it. Over the weekend, Colorado Rapids got their third positive result in a row, their second straight win. They defeated the Vancouver Whitecaps by the score of 1-0, ruining Canada Day for everybody up in British Columbia. It was an own goal by
Is that a real holiday, or did you just make that up?
No, this is really a thing.
No,
this is a
thing.
Google this right now.
But they're not even independent from the Queen. So
no, but it's them celebrating.
Don't they just have high tea at 4:30 every day? Isn't that their version of Canada Day?
You're asking me to make sense of Canada right now, Mark. Like, where do I even start with that?
I'll never understand Canada.
They export maple syrup and snow and moose.
Yeah. I think they probably do export moose.
I would not be surprised at all.
But we do too in Colorado. We have moose. We must be. Anyways, we're back to the banter part of the thing. Go.
Okay, so an own goal by Marcel Dejong in the 43rd minute off of an own goal. Really nice cross into the box, I want to say, by Danny Wilson, and Joe Mason kind of pings it, it goes off the post. Joe Mason goes for it and then ends up bouncing off of one Vancouver defender, then off of Dejong and into the back of the net. That is the only goal of the game, Mark. Vancouver dominated in a number of stats that Paolo Mascherini would never in any way care about. They had over 70% of the ball. You had a bunch of yellow cards from Rapid players, including Jack Price in the 16th minute. But, you know, other than a couple of really good header chances for Kai Kamara that he didn't do a whole lot with, and then a few chances in which Tim Howard was in a perfect position to make a save, Mark, I'm going to piss off some of our listeners. I'm going to get some of
Please
our
do.
Listeners very excited. This was the most hashtag keep fighting result of the 2018 season for the Colorado Rapids. Regardless of whether or not you think it was pretty, it was a bit of a hodgepodge lineup given the fact that the Rapids will be playing three games in 8 days, if I'm not mistaken. You had a pretty conservative 5-4-1. Axel Schuberg made his first appearance in a while since his concussion. Nana Boateng started in at right back of all places. You had Sam Nicholson and Joe Mason out on the wing. You had Danny Wilson in midfield. It was kind of crazy, but it was extremely effective. And, you know, in most cases with MLS teams, you would say going on the road in this defensive low block and giving the team a ball is a recipe for bunkering and hoping for a 0-0 draw. But as we discussed last last week, the Vancouver Whitecaps are kind of like a dog chasing cars, and when you voluntarily give them possession, that's them catching the car, and they have no idea what to do with it. And other than Alphonso Davies making a couple runs, and Kai Kamara getting a few header chances that he didn't do a whole lot with, the Vancouver Whitecaps did not know what to do with the ball, and as a result, the Rapids got a win. Mark, your general thoughts on this game, and what was your big thing, or your good thing from this match?
I don't have a lot, because I was performing a wedding, so I wasn't able to watch, the game live. I caught, it afterwards, and I mostly just hit the high points. The formation was really interesting, and, I mean, the formation was the same, but, you know, moving, someone like, Danny Wilson into the midfield, or at least officially he was in the midfield. I feel like the Rapids were kind of switching and moving their backline five up, and, you know, dropping their midfielders in kind of a total football-y kind of, you know, keep the shape. But for the most part, you know, the good thing I think was that, most importantly, Tim Howard had a really good game. He made, I think, 10 saves. I'll look it up now so that I don't sound like an idiot on a podcast for all posterity's sake. But, you know, it seems to me that, the dominant, one of our narratives of the Rapids is that, Matt looked it up. There's 10, he had 10 saves. One of the narratives that MLS, folks have for the Rapids, whether they pay attention or not, is that Tim Howard is old and trash and can't move anymore. And, he is the root of all of the team's problems. And I think, statistics up to this point have generally shown that Tim Howard is a league average goalkeeper. And I'll keep an eye on this and I'll update us as we go through the season, maybe starting with next week. But, for Tim Howard to have an above average game, on nearly the 1 year anniversary of, the game against Belgium 4 years ago, in which he stood on his head and got 16 staves, is really great. I mean, the man can still do a job. He can still do it. Granted, solidly, 8 of those saves were absolute gimmies, and there were a number of situations where Vancouver had opportunities, and Kai Kamara put a header right at the goalkeeper, and, you know.
Or the one that he hit off the crossbar.
Yeah, it's, you know, Vancouver had their chances, and they did not take them. But the Rapids went in and, you know, basically hung tight. Matt, your thoughts on a good thing?
As I said previously, just getting a win. You know, they've had 3 consecutive games against 3 very beatable teams that weren't necessarily in a great position. Didn't play very well and got a draw against the Chicago Fire. That feels like ages ago now with the World Cup starting. And then obviously, you know, a climactic, but I think a needed and a cathartic win, last weekend, against Minnesota United to break the winless streak. And, you know, this was just, you know, the way that Vancouver was playing, the fact that they were shorthanded, Kendall Waston and Bolaños were not yet back from the World Cup, even though Costa Rica got eliminated. They had a couple red cards, Vancouver did against, Philly that kind of left them shorthanded. You know, this was very much a winnable game, and you don't get a whole lot of those with where the Rapids are right now, particularly when you're playing a team on turf, where you have a little bit more travel going up to Vancouver. You know, that's one of the longer trips the Rapids will have, being kind of in the centroid of the Western Conference as far as stadiums are concerned. And ultimately they went there and got 3 points. And this is, you know, that they got a little bit lucky that they kind of got the bad Vancouver on their day, but those are points that other teams are potentially going to drop, or they're only going to get a 1-1 draw, or, you know, maybe if Jordy Reyna doesn't get that red card against Philly, then Vancouver finds a way to win that game 2-1. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think at this point right now, the team just needs results, and whether or not that, I'll get to this, to my big thing. Like, at this point, it doesn't necessarily matter how it comes.
Yeah.
You know, as I said previously, this was kind of the hashtag keep fighting. It's, we're going to be defensive. We're going to get a couple chances. We're going to try and convert on them. The opponent's going to have more of the ball, but we're not going to let them get anything dangerous of them. This is the most, and I think that's the most effective that was.
And to that point, Matt Doyle trolled all Rapids Nation, both of us, by showing the 5-4-1 lineup that the Rapids were going with, and also the fact that there was a straight up center back in the midfield, and then quote tweeting on top of it, part of the Rapids Way op-ed that Porik authored with Wayne a number of months ago about being attractive attacking football. I don't care about attractive attacking football. I've never cared about attractive attacking football. I just want to win. And when you go on the road, and it's in the middle of the season, dog days of summer, and you're on turf, you do whatever it takes. And if you put 11 men behind the ball and irritate your opponent, then that's what you do to get a win. So the Rapids got their first road win. So I 100% agree with you. It's about fighting. It's about results. It doesn't have to be pretty soccer, and I'm fine with that.
Okay, Marco, what was your bad thing from this game?
How many goals does Yannick Bolli have this season?
I'm going to say one. It was a PK against Portland.
My next question was going to be, although you've ruined it, thank you very much, my next question was going to be how many goals from the run of play?
Zero!
He has zero goals from the run of play. He doesn't have that many minutes. You know, he has 441 minutes, 10 games started, and a total of, sorry, 4 games started and 10 games played. That's a lot of nothing for a dude who's earning almost $1 million a year. I think he's making 940.
Sounds about right.
That's a lot of money to not score goals, considering that Baji's making, I think, 160, maybe 220.
That's Giovanni Dos Santos level conversion rate.
He's scoring a lot more goals. That always drives me nuts, and I know that, like, you know, this is the way of the world, that when you're a proven goal striker in your 30s, you're going to get paid to play. And when you're a youngin and you're restricted by the way the mechanics of contracts work, then you're not. But that totally frustrates me. And Bully's got to really, you know, show up and do whatever it takes. I don't see him making hard runs. I don't see him popping up. He does good hold-up play, but we already had that guy, and that's Dominic Baji. Matt, your thoughts? Bad thing?
Lots of chances in the air for the Vancouver Whitecaps,
right,
against the lineup that you would thought defensively was going to be, you know, your anti-aircraft, material. You know, you had Danny Wilson in the midfield, who would, I assume, was in the box for every single set piece or long cross Vancouver had, getting numbers up the field. You had Tommy Smith and you had Axel Schuberg in there, at the center back role. Obviously, Tim Howard is decent, defensively in the air. I want to say Court Ford subbed into this game. Yes, Mark?
60th minute? 70th minute?
Let me check that right now so that we don't look bad on this podcast.
We've said that enough times that we've already pretty much proven that we look bad.
61st minute, he came in for Nana Boateng, so that would have been his first MLS minutes
of
the game.
The thing is, we've been right every time, and we've second-guessed ourselves 3 times. This is what happens when we do a podcast right after watching England choke away a 1-0 lead and then get their confidence back in PKs. We lack the confidence. We need to believe, just like the English national team. We need to believe in these numbers that we may be spouting correctly or not. All right, keep going.
Mark. So, keep it rolling. You know, you would say that Aerolee is a very, very good team, to where Kai Kamara should be double teamed on every single cross and have no opportunity to get the ball whatsoever. And he got 3 or 4 solid looks on goal that maybe the Kai Kamara that almost won the Golden Boot with Columbus Crew several years ago would have converted. Yeah. The Kai Kamara that you remember from being a young and very talented player with Sporting Kansas City, eventually got a very good opportunity to play with Norwich, I believe, in the Premier League, would have finished. So that was not good, especially given the personnel that you had. Maybe Danny Wilson having a little bit different marking role, not being a center back. Maybe Axel's first game in a while. Maybe Court Ford's first game since CCL. Maybe that had much of a factor. But for that kind of a lineup, I would say there should be no header opportunities for the opponent.
Right.
And on a better day, you could have made an argument Rapid should not have gotten 3 points out of this game. And then on my other thing is just not really in the context of this game, but when we spoke about the Houston Dynamo game, feels like a month ago now, I can't remember when it actually was, where they essentially did the same thing of coming out with a 5-4-1, and just from the beginning, I did not care for that game plan given the opponent. This was a very specific game plan for very specifically the Vancouver Whitecaps. I can count on one hand the number of MLS teams that will play at home during a busy schedule for the opponent and willingly want to and have the plan A be not playing with the ball. So this plan will work for the Vancouver Whitecaps. It might be able to work for the Montreal Impact this coming Saturday.
Nice.
It didn't work against the Houston Dynamo. It certainly didn't work against It certainly didn't work against New York City. This is not a game plan that is a recipe for success.
It's
on the road if the Rapids want to make the playoffs this year.
It's an interesting observation that I did not pick up until you just said it, which is that the other times that we've used the 5-4-1, which the way that it looked the last couple times I did not notice in this game, but the last two times it was a box midfield.
Yes.
Where essentially the two kind of wing players for the Rapids form the forward line, and then you're basically playing with two defensive midfielders and five defenders in the line.
It'd be a 5-2-2-1, I guess.
It's a 5-2. I think it's a 5-2-2-1. We had Twitter likes to argue about formation, but the other two games that we played, it were Houston where we lost, and in the U.S. Open Cup against Nashville, which we also lost. But the idea I think behind all three of those games is, these are teams that are going to want to strike on the counterattack. And if they're going to strike us on the counterattack, we want to have seven men deep, and we want to cut off the ability to run through our middle, because that's where it's most dangerous. So that worked here. We shall see if this is kind of the – if we want to peer into the mind of Anthony Hudson – if the question become the question that we want to ask going forward is, will we see 5-4-1s every time we face a potential counterattacking opponent? And I think that that's, or a team that plays, it plays very fast from the wings on the break, like a team, like Vancouver, who has Davies, who can cause mayhem. And Davies caused a fair amount of mayhem in this game. He breaks loose. He gets wide. He either drives towards you or he plays in that last ball towards Kai Kamara, and you're in deep trouble. But, you know, because we had enough bodies in the box, it worked out okay mostly here.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you there, Mark. I guess, you know, Hudson's alluded to me on a couple of different occasions wanting to have a second go-to formation that's a club in the bag. I wonder if this is him trying to develop and, you know, hashtag trust the process with, say, a 5-4-1 that's a variation or a sidestep,
right,
a cousin of his 3-5-2.
Because he has multiple clubs in the bag, because the other club in the bag, which isn't one that I like seeing, is when the Rapids are down one or two goals, they effectively go to a 3-4-3. They push both of their wings up, and then they tend to push one of their midfielders or even one of those wings all the way up into being like a striker. And sometimes it even looks like a 3-3-4 late in the game when the Rapids are putting four bodies on that back line. And
when Tommy Smith decides to be a forward.
Right. When we're trying to occupy space. So,
yeah.
So that's a club in the bag that you don't want. If you guys know golf at all, that's what's called an L wedge, a wedge that you take out of your bag once in a blue moon. And if you only have, if you're out there on a Sunday with your buddies and you have 28 clubs in your bag and you're paying some poor kid to lug that 80,000 pound bag around the golf cart course, then you have that bag. If you're in a PGA regulation match where you only get, I think, 13 clubs, you don't have an L wedge.
Yeah,
anyway.
I would say if you're being forced to pull out the L wedge, Mark, you've done something to put yourself in
right.
a very precarious
position. Our 3-4-3 is the L wedge.
Yes. So moving on, Mark, let's get to big things. The big thing for me going into this game, I am a big fan, not necessarily of momentum, but of the placebo effect. The game against the Chicago Fire wasn't pretty. The Rapids did a lot of things very, very poorly in that game. The Rapids had a very poor first half against the Minnesota United. Maybe with, you know, Miguel Ibarra losing his head and a lucky chance off of a corner, they were able to get a result. There were a number of things they did really well in this game. There were a number of things that they could have done much better, all things considered. I don't necessarily care about that, given how deep of a hole this team was in 3 weeks ago, to where at this point, you just need to get results to get your confidence up. So maybe it's not that they're doing a whole lot of things that actually give you belief that they're going to eventually turn this around, or they're not transitioning this into 90-minute performances, comprehensive performances with improving on things here and there. But at this point, maybe it's just the placebo effect of they were playing so poorly, you know, going back to what we were talking about with confidence, where it's, oh crap, I don't want to make the mistake, I don't want to extend the losing streak, as opposed to whether or not it's real or whether or not what they've done has been effective to get results. Just simply getting the result builds confidence to where maybe Declan Wynn isn't worried about making a mistake, and as a result he makes a mistake, he actually makes a play, so to speak. So I don't know if these past three games have been performances indicative that this team could turn it around and make the playoffs, but somewhere in there, at some point in the amygdala hindbrain of all of these players, they have to be thinking, we've gotten three results, we can go out and we can beat a bad Seattle Sounders team on Wednesday.
Yes.
We can go out and we can get a result against the Montreal Impact. And then if we do that, we're potentially back in the hunt. And then maybe we can actually think that we can do something, and that might actually be bigger than actually playing convincing winning soccer right now.
In MLS, especially in the Western Conference this year, you don't need to be good. You need to feed on the chum of the league. And the chum of the league is, it can be Vancouver, although Vancouver has moments where they're good, but the chum of the league is absolutely Seattle away midweek in a game that will happen during daylight hours when it's going to be 90 degrees, right? Like Seattle is in a bad situation coming into this one. And then Montreal on the road. Now, Montreal's kind of bounced back the last four games. I think they're on a streak. But this is a team that is not good. So, you've got a real opportunity here to kind of make up points.
I guess on that note, Mark, shall we move ahead to...
My last big thing is this. A Jewish wedding always has free booze. I know people do cash bar at non-Jewish weddings, and I understand how these things are, but the cultural norm of my people is an open bar. But unfortunately, it's very difficult to make bar decisions when you buy only bottom shelf liquor. So, like, there was no good whiskey and there was no good scotch at this wedding. And I just want to say, people, just chip in the extra bucks for, like, the mid-shelf whiskey and scotch. These are important things, especially for the rabbi. At least buy the rabbi a nice bottle of scotch. Anyhow.
Mark, we are currently 16-34 through the MLS regular season. That reduces down to 8-17. The Colorado Rapids are currently in 10th place in the Western Conference, just 8 points out of the playoffs. Can you believe it?
And as we noted, as I noted before when we were talking before the podcast started, we've been moving up the MLS power rankings. We are in 20th place. There are three teams below us. So, you know, that's always important. Perception matters, Matt.
Yes, 4 wins, 9 losses, and 3 draws this week, Mark. They will be playing at Wednesday for Fourth Fest against the Seattle Sounders. That is I don't even know when that kickoff is in my brain, actually.
Shouldn't it be a 7 p.m.? That's when I would do it.
It is a 7 p.m. Mountain Time kickoff, and then...
See? We're second-guessing ourselves. Yes. This is England's fault.
We're going to have confidence here, Mark. And then I'm going to say that it is a 5:30 Mountain Standard Time kickoff against the Montreal Impact on Saturday. That is a road game, folks. The Rapid Seattle Sounders currently in second, tied for second to last, in 11th place in the Western Conference. 12 points off, 3 wins, 3 losses, and 3 draws. And then the Montreal Impact are in 7th in the Eastern Conference, 21 points. That's with 7 wins, 11 losses, and 0 ties. Can you believe it, Mark? And then just to confirm with you, they've won their last 3 games, and they've won 3 of their last 4, that lone loss at FC Dallas, their only Western Conference opponent during that streak, Mark. The Seattle Sounders are kind of that aging core right now, Mark. They've got a lot of really good players. They've made the last 2 MLS Cups. I don't need to go down the Clint Dempseys, the Christian Roldans, the Ozzie Alonzos of the world, so to speak, but they have a very old aging core, and they have not been good on the road so far, and they had a pretty crazy but ultimately a losing effort against the Portland Timbers in Cascadia action over the weekend. Your thoughts generally and quickly on the Sounders, Mark?
They're hot steaming trash, and we should beat the bejesus out of them. Seattle have only won once in their last 7 outings. It was a 2-1 win at home over DC United. Their starting lineup this last week included Brian Meredith in goal, who I don't know how many starts he has in MLS. I had to look him up. Because Stefan Fry was hurt, and I think Stefan Fry will still probably be out for this coming game. They're going with Will Bruin up top, who's probably just fine considering, but, when they lost, Wonder Boy, striker for the U.S. men's national team, only has a right foot.
Jordan Morris.
All right. Stanford. Right. When they lost, Jordan Morris to a torn ACL at the very, very beginning of the season, maybe even in preseason, it was kind of lights out for them because their backup plan was, did not exist. Clint Dempsey has been totally missing in action this season. Nico Ladera has been really disappointing. Their wing Their other winger on the other side is Victor Rodriguez, who is, you know, really...
He's been bad.
Yeah, and, you know, other than that, they have Gustav Svensson, but he's been away with Sweden for the World Cup.
And he will not be eligible for this game, as Sweden is through to the quarterfinals as of today.
Yeah, Ozzie Alonso looks tired and old and slow. He just doesn't cover ground. Christian Roldan is fantastic. But that's your lineup. You know, and then you've got, at right back, they've been switching between Jordan McCrary and, Nuhu Tolo. And, Nuhu is the kind of guy who is spectacular in open field. He's super fast. He can make an amazing play and then have a ridiculously stupid brain fart play where he just plays it to the opposition on the break to give away a goal. So that's really questionable. And then their bench is absolute trash. It's Lamar Nagel, Magnus Wolf Ekram, who's been really below average, and Harry Shipp, who's been last listed as a defender, which
when he 3 years ago, he was the young, exciting, homegrown number 10 for the Chicago Fire.
This lineup can't really get it done anywhere, isn't getting it done. And, you know, their best hope is to make the Rapids try and score on them. Cede possession to Colorado, kind of bunker in deep, take away zone 14 and defend crosses, which makes for a really bad game potentially. But I honestly think that at Seattle, you know, if the Rapids going up to Vancouver was just let's attempt to get a result at all odds, you know, and not play attractive football, it's probably time for Seattle to start, you know, getting into desperation. And the reality of that is just that Brian Schmetzer is the coach. And I think, Seattle is the kind of place where you don't get a long leash. And I think maybe the fans expected more from him. You know, his head is probably in a noose right now. So he's got to get some results in the next five games. So, you know, even a couple draws would help save his job.
This is a bad team. I think if there's any team right now, Mark, that they're going to have to do something miraculous in trying to make the playoffs for, I think, Garth Lagerwey or whoever's in leadership standpoint come this offseason, not completely press the reset button, start to phase out all the veteran players, maybe bring up a couple S2 guys and make a few other moves. I guess just one last note I'll put on, two last notes I'll put on the Sounders and then move on to brace for impact here. Mark, the Seattle Sounders, this past week did officially announce their long announced DP signing. They signed Peruvian forward Raul Ruiz Diaz, who just finished up, with Peru at the World Cup. His contract technically does not go through until the international transfer window opens, which is July 10th, which means he will not be eligible for the game tomorrow. So reason to worry about
him. I love the announcements that happen before the window and then you have to qualify it by saying he can't play. It's the window, which is like, you know, I'm sure there's going to be thousands of people who tune into the DC United game this week being like, I can't wait to see Manchester United's Wayne Rooney.
And he's sitting there on the sideline in a polo shirt and he runs out to clap the fans.
There will be some hardcore fans who will like just be there to see him, you know, wave from the balcony. Although they're probably on the road.
They're at a Galaxy.
They've got another couple weeks till Audi opens.
Yeah.
Say that with confidence.
So this is a bad Sounders team, folks, and this is a team that if you want to make the playoffs, you should beat them and have a solid performance over them. Moving on, Mark, this Saturday, completing out their really busy last week and a half or so, the Rapids will travel to Montreal Impact. As previously stated, they've won three games in a row, including a 2-0 drubbing for all intensive purposes over Sporting Kansas City over the weekend. The Impact have kind of been up and down, Mark. They have Ignacio Piatti, one of the best number 10s in the league. However, he's really, really old. Mancosu's had a couple good moments. They shuffled out a bunch of old pieces in the midfield. Fani and Camacho, two center backs, are finally healthy. Montreal's defense has been abhorrent this season, but it's been entirely based on them having injuries. There's questions about whether or not Remy Gard has maybe lost the locker room or so, but, you know, this is a team that's the answer to the question, what if the Twitter voices who only react based on what they saw the last week were like how they performed, that is the Montreal Impact. And right now, for all intents and purposes, everything is wonderful and glorious and filled with poutine up north of the border. Mark, what do you make of the Montreal Impact? How do the Rapids handle them?
I think you said it really well, that this is a one-man team and you just don't let him get loose on you and you should be okay.
Yep.
That's Ignacio Piatti. Other than that, this team is really floundering and struggling, Mateo Mancuso can do a job for you if you let them get into space in a 2v4 even, Piatti and Mancuso. You're looking for problems. One of the things I don't understand about the Impact is they let go of Dom Oduro in the offseason, who is, you know, he's Oduro is can be relied upon to miss goals from nearly point blank range at regular intervals, but he also has flat out speed that you can't miss, and he creates problems that stretch and pull apart your team. They don't have guys like that anymore. They have Ignacio Piatti, who you have to double down on, and then a bunch of traffic cones that you don't really need to worry about. And defensively, they're fine, but not good. So they struggle to really create difficulties for anybody. In their last match, they did go out and get a result against Sporting Kansas City, and they did that with, you know, getting goals from Piatti and earning a PK. So... and they did it also by holding serve in the first half.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that we've watched a lot of World Cup. We watched a bunch of World Cup together. You know, one of those things you see in knockout level World Cup matches is just hold on for dear life in the first half. And then you can shrink the game and turn it into something that has more to do with fitness, individual mistakes, and so forth later on in the game. That'll be...
Can you go full Russia on Spain?
Yeah, that'll be Montreal's game plan probably for the rest of the season, which is just, you know, boil the game down to hang on for the first 45 minutes and then take the next 45 minutes and break it down into little 15-minute segments of, here, we're going to really come at you.
So. The big thing for me in this game, Mark, is just looking at it, you know, how does Hudson go about approaching this game? Does he go about it how I think we both think he'll approach the Sounders and how he did it against Minnesota United? Or do you potentially pull out the 5-4-1 or whatever variation of it is purely to neutralize Ignacio Piatti? Do they go in there with the similar game plan they had against Vancouver or against Houston? Or do they try and play with them? Do they make adjustments at halftime? And how much of that is dictated by just where this team's going to be fitness-wise, having to do some travel throughout the past week? We didn't get to it, folks, but the Rapids actually had some travel complexities.
Yep.
Their flight was rerouted yesterday, so they're actually training in Vancouver today on Tuesday. So their first game, their first training session, quote-unquote, back at Dick's Sporting Goods Park will actually be the warm-up for the game tomorrow. So that, plus traveling again to Montreal. Montreal's not playing in the midweek because Canada doesn't do 4th of July games. What does that look like for them? And how much of that is just a function of, oh, well, so-and-so's hurt, I want to give such-and-such a run out, and maybe that maybe limits Hudson, or where he has to get a little bit creative? How does he approach that, and does the team execute
I think
effectively?
That's a really good point. I think the interesting point to bring up with that is if you're looking at two soccer teams and asking the question, how are they going to do on short rest, it has to do with depth, right?
Yes.
And Seattle also lacks depth severely.
Yes.
Montreal has a really weird, I think, they have a really good bench that they're not playing. Shamit Shomi is a pretty good midfielder who's young and just hasn't really gotten a run out. Juko Raitala is also on their bench and played effectively in spurts for Columbus last year. Anthony Jackson Hamel and Raheem Edwards were both really excellent players, both with Toronto last year. Jackson Hamel was with Montreal, but Raheem Edwards was with Toronto. That's a strong bench. And one of the things that I have asked other writers on my website around MLS who follow Montreal better is why haven't those guys gotten off the bench? And the answer is basically, I don't know, man. Remigard doesn't like them. So, and, you know, other guys.
Remigard's a bit of a Jose Mourinho crazy nutcase, head scratching decisions all around kind of manager.
I mean, the guys who are on the field for him are older than those guys that I mentioned. Safir Titer is fine, but he's 26. Payet is 23. He's not an old guy, but he's also not a good player. He's never really shown up as much of a kind of, he's supposed to be a two-way midfielder, and he's kind of not a lot of anything. He's kind of like Jack Price if he didn't distribute the ball diagonally really well. So I don't know, man. I think Montreal's a winnable game, but they're on the upswing, so you never know.
Yeah, okay, listeners, shortly we're going to head over to an interview I had with Dr. Goff, who's a professor at Lynchburg College. He's the author of Gold Medal Physics and a semi-regular guest on Playing with Science. That's a Neil deGrasse Tyson Star Talk Radio spinoff where they talk about sports and science. And he's basically the expert on soccer balls and how the physics and fluid dynamics takes place. And I talked to him about the Telstar 18, about playing at altitude and soccer ball movement and physics at altitude, and a number of other fun little topics. So we'll get to that. To get that out of here, Mark, follow us individually on Twitter at Rapids Rabbi and at LWS Matt Pollard. Follow us collectively at Rapids 96 Podcast, and you can email us at rapids96podcast@gmail.com. Find us wherever you have find us at your preferred podcatcher. We're on pretty much everywhere. We are trying to get on Spotify. I'm still working with Blueberry on that front, so I do apologize about that. And listeners, do we want to tease the interview we're trying to get this week, Mark?
Nope. Let's keep you in suspense.
Okay. We'll be having a potentially big interview that'll be out sometime next week. Ooh. Okay. Until then, listeners, try to play with confidence. We'll see you next week, folks. Happy 4th of July. Welcome back, listeners. This is Matt Pollard. I'm currently on the campus of Lynchburg College, soon to be renamed the University of Lynchburg, and I'm here with Professor Goff, Eric Goff, the department head for the physics department on campus and the author of Gold Medal Physics and an occasional guest on the Playing with Science podcast. Professor, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on.
So, first of all, Eric, you're not the first PhD I've ever interviewed for this, so I have to ask, as a former grad student myself, what was your PhD thesis on, and what sort of research are you doing these days, soccer ball related or otherwise?
So, at Indiana University, I was doing a condensed matter theory PhD, specifically studying metal optics near surfaces of metals, and it was a highly computational project. When I started doing my work at Lynchburg College, as it was known, in 2002, the students that I had are exclusively undergraduates, so we do not have a graduate school, and I wanted to get them involved in research, and several of my early students were interested in cycling and soccer, so we started developing projects in that direction, and some of those research areas have really taken off and just kind of snowballed from there. So right now I model the Tour de France every year. We've got a lot of publications on that and students that have worked on that. My current student is actually down the hall in our lab right now working on this. And of course the soccer work has been going on since 2006. So we study World Cup balls. My sabbaticals at the University of Sheffield in England, it involved also tennis. We look at friction between shoes and tennis courts.
Excellent stuff. So let's get into the actual soccer ball science here, listeners. We've got a Brazuca from the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, and then the Telstar 18 that's currently being used in Russia at the 2018 World Cup. Eric, what sorts of phenomena and variables are involved in a soccer ball movement? You obviously have friction from the surface going on. You've got crosses in which there's wind, players putting spin on the ball, you know, like Ronaldo trying to score a free kick over the wall. What sort of variables are in play there? How significant are they?
So once the ball leaves the player's boot, of course, you've got the air resistance acting on the ball, and you've got the Earth's gravitational tug, or the weight of the ball. The balls are nearly a pound, about 95% of a pound in weight, and the air that's rushing around the surface of the ball has a peculiar type of flow around it at different speeds. And So the different types of flow speeds change the character of the air resistance that's acting on the ball. And if the ball happens to be spinning, you can actually get the air to be whipped off in a certain direction and create this lovely banana kick that you're used to seeing, this so-called Magnus force pushing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the studies that I've done with my colleagues in Japan at the University of Tsukuba, they have a wind tunnel where we put these balls in, and we've actually published some work now showing that the surface of these balls is a very, very strong player in the type of aerodynamics with the ball. Just changing the grooves and the seams and the width and the depth of the grooves or the seam height, all this can have very drastic changes on the aerodynamics of the ball.
For the sake of our listeners, can you define the Magnus force?
Sure. So I like to make that analogy with a boat. If you're ever riding a boat and you look out the back of the boat, you see the wake of the water kind of rippling behind the boat. And as long as you're going straight, the water that's separated off the boat at the back just ripples back straight. If you want to turn the boat, you got to turn the rudder. And as soon as you turn the rudder, that wake of water on the boat gets deflected in one direction. And we learned over 300 years ago from Isaac Newton, if the boat's going to push the water in one direction, the water's got to push the boat in the other direction. So that's how the boat turns. Well, the same thing happens with the ball. The air that is being whipped around the back of the ball gets whipped off in a certain direction. If the ball's not spinning, it's mostly, and we can talk about knuckle effects in a moment, but it's mostly whipped off in the back opposite the ball's velocity. So it's just straight off the back of the ball. If the ball is spinning, then the air will get whipped off to one side. So we call this an asymmetric shedding of the boundary layer in the technical lingo. But the air will come off whipped to one side. And if the air gets pushed to one side, the air's got to be pushing the ball to the other direction. So that's how you get this, what I like to call a banana kick with whipped air. You have this beautiful effect of the Magnus force pushing sideways on the ball based on the way it's spinning.
So some of your more recent research has obviously been on the Telstar 18. In previous work that I've done, obviously there's a lot of maligning of the Jabulani that was at the 2010 World Cup. As I understand it, the Brazuca was well liked by free kick takers, not so much by goalkeepers. Kind of a hybrid design with the Telstar. What can you tell us a little bit about that ball as it relates to what's been affecting the World Cup in the last couple weeks?
Well, I think every World Cup, you get a couple weeks into it, and people call it crazy or call the goals crazy. I think it's not necessarily anything special about this one, but the evolution of the World Cup soccer balls is interesting because Adidas has had the contract since 1970 when the Telstar was used at that time. It was a black and white design, familiar to a lot of us that we had when we were kids, and that was because most people had black and white televisions. And they had to be able to see the ball moving and if it was spinning and all that. They had to be able to see it on a black and white screen. This year's Telstar is paying homage to that black and white color scheme. You do have a little bit of a kind of a gold color with the Adidas and the World Cup logo for 2018. But the panels for the ball up until 2002 with the Korea-Japan World Cup, the Fevronova ball that was used, was the same 32-panel hexagons and pentagons ball that we've all played with as kids. And those balls were made with stitching with the panels, either by hand in the past or machines coming up later on. In 2006, that was the first time Adidas released a ball that was not of that traditional design. That was the Teamgeist ball used in Germany. The 14-panel Teamgeist, the grooves were very curved. And you run the risk when you start taking away panel number, meaning you've got fewer seams on the ball, perhaps, of making the ball too smooth. And what happens there is, it may be counterintuitive, but if you make the ball too polished, too smooth, it has more air drag. And in 2010, when the Jabulani came along, it had just 8 panels. So now Adidas is really worried. Their panel number's going down. They got to make sure the ball's not too smooth. And these are now thermally bonded panels starting in 2006, so they are better about keeping water out and keeping the ball from getting heavier. So those 8 panels with Jabulani turned out were enough of a reduction in the roughness of the surface that they had to put some kind of texturing on the surface of the panels. And you could run your fingers over to no longer feel smooth. So what would happen is when the ball was kicked, it would look like it would travel pretty decently. And then about halfway into its motion, it looked like it started getting more drag. And there's a fancy term that we use in fluid mechanics called a drag crisis. And this refers to the way the type of flow over the ball changes. And you really don't want that drag crisis to happen in the middle of speeds where you see corner kicks and free kicks. So there's some spectacular examples. I mean, Honda for Japan had a great free kick goal in that 2010 World Cup, I remember, where it just looked like a beach ball flying toward the goalkeeper. So what Brazuca did, it had two fewer panels than Giovellani, just six panels on Brazuca, but the seam shape is much more circuitous than the Giovellani, and it had actually 68% longer total seam length. And that added seam length made the ball rougher despite the two fewer panels than Giovellani. And that added roughness reduced the air drag so that this drag crisis got pushed down to a lower speed. So now you flash forward to 2018, and the Telstar 18 also has six panels, but they're very different shaped panels. Puzzle pieces, I think, is what you might have used the term earlier. But this actually has 30% longer total seam length than the Giovellani, than the Brazuca panels. So the total seam length here went up by 30%. Now you run the risk of making the ball too rough. And you don't want to make the aerodynamics for the players so different that, you know, they're kicking balls that just look like beach ball one year and a roughened ball another year. So to compensate for the fact that the total seam length went up by 30%, what Adidas did was they made the seams narrower and shallower. So that takes a little bit of the roughness out. And the surface texturing isn't as tall as it is on Brazuca. And if you hold the two balls, you can tell the Brazuca, actually the panels feel a little rougher because its texturing is a little taller than on the Telstar. I don't know if you can tell that or not.
Yes, I'm holding them both right now, listeners, and I'd say it's almost like a medium light sandpaper material almost on the Brazuca, and a much finer one that I'm noticing on the Telstar, and I'd say the same of the grooving material in terms of the depth of the grooves on the Telstar being less than that of the Brazuca. Am I in the ballpark?
Yeah. So the Brazuca, if you're just feeling the panels and feeling the grooves, it'll feel rougher, but the subtle difference with the Telstar is that its total seam length is longer. So they're actually less fraction of the area where you have panels and more where you have the seams. So that's how they get away with having the changes in the seam and the texturing. And the aerodynamics of the two balls are similar. They're not exactly the same. You can't make them exactly the same, but as long as the drag crisis is at about the same speed, which it is for the two balls, they're aerodynamically very similar.
What is that speed at which the drag crisis occurs, and what is the drag crisis?
So when the ball's moving fast, and by fast I mean, you know, well in excess of coming off a foot at, say, 60 miles an hour, the flow we call is turbulent around the ball. And that turbulent flow allows the air to go around the ball, and it separates farther back on the ball. So when you slow the ball down through the air with air resistance, Giovellani suffered this fate on a corner kick, let's say. It would slow down to a point where the flow would change from turbulent to laminar. And what laminar flow is, it's not as chaotic as the turbulent flow patterns on the back of the ball, but it separates a lot sooner on the ball. And that actually leads to a larger, what we call drag coefficient. So for the same speed, if I had two balls, one of them with laminar flow, one of them with turbulent flow, if they were moving at the same speed, the one with the turbulent flow would actually have a lot less drag, perhaps by a factor of two. So it would be moved traveling faster. So the Brazuca and the Telstar have a drag crisis at about 38 miles an hour. Now, if you're kicking the ball, corner kicks, free kicks, long distances for the goalkeepers, the 38 mile per hour part of the speed might be down near the pitch, near the ground. So it's not really influencing the main part of the trajectory. Giovellani was around 54 miles an hour. So you kick a ball at 65 miles an hour and it slows to 54 miles an hour and its aerodynamic properties change, and the drag would go up. So that's not really a problem with the past two balls for the World Cup.
Excellent. Let's move on to altitude factors. I live in Denver, Colorado, home of the Colorado Rapids in Major League Soccer. Dick's Sporting Goods Park out in Commerce City is right just under, I think it's a 5,100 and change, roughly, feet altitude. I looked it up the other day and making some assumptions without going into too much detail, listeners, the actual air density and pressure can vary with humidity and temperature that we won't go into, but roughly about 20% less in terms of mass per volume that you have at that altitude as opposed to at sea level. How does that affect the movement of the ball and what other variables are in play?
So air resistance on the ball is directly proportional to the air density. As you say, you know, how heavy the air is in a given volume. So if you imagine running your hand through the air, you don't feel a lot of resistance. But if you run it through the water, you get a lot more resistance. Well, water's, you know, for the same volume is about 800 times heavier. Then you go to honey. I mean, you can get things with a lot more density in them and impede the motion of whatever's trying to travel through them. So a fluid like air, it's about a little more than about 1.2 kilograms in a cubic meter. So that may not sound like a lot, but if you're ever in a car and you stick your hand out the window of a car, we've all done this, you know, you put your palm out and you feel a lot of air resistance and you turn at 90 degrees in airplane mode and you don't get as much air resistance and you might even notice a little lift if you're turning it the right way. So you can definitely feel the air drag there. In fact, most of a car's gasoline is fighting air drag at high speeds. So that air drag on the ball, when you're playing at elevation, goes down. And you know in Denver, say if we're talking about the Colorado Rockies, going to a baseball example, you get a lot less air resistance on the ball, so a pitcher can throw a fastball a little faster, but you can't throw as good a curveball. Because the Magnus force also depends on the air density. So you don't get quite the same bite on your curveball, even though you can throw your fastball a little faster in Denver. Humidity does play a slight role, but not nearly the kind of role that temperature plays. So a humid evening tends to make the air resistance go down because you're replacing nitrogen and oxygen with water molecules, which are lighter. So anyone who's ever played with the ideal gas law can understand that. But the humidity effects aren't nearly as strong as temperature. When the temperature rises, the air resistance goes down. And you know, really hot days, anyone who's ever watched baseball in July and August, the ball is going to fly a little farther than it will in October in the World Series. So altitude and temperature are big players in the air density, and that definitely affects the Magnus force and the air resistance.
So just proportionally to your curveball example, you'd get less of the banana shape on a free cake, you know, say just outside the box, trying to go over the wall and curl inside the top corner.
Yeah, so the free kicks, you're going to have a lot less of the Magnus force, a lot less bend. They'll be faster. You know, my favorite example was 2010, where in South Africa, about half the matches were played at high altitude. And when you got to the final between Spain and the Netherlands, it seemed like Spain had the advantage on where they've been playing their World Cup compared to the Netherlands as far as altitude goes. And if you think about a team that likes to do the short passes, I mean, Spain's beautiful with their short passing game. The Jabalani ball that had so much difficulty with these long kicks, you might even argue favored a team like Spain because, you know, they kept it down on the ground a lot with their short passing game. So in Russia, you know, you have a lot of the stadia, like on the Volga and other, you know, the rivers. And so there are a lot of, you know, sea level type altitudes as well. But I don't think it's going to be quite as drastic in altitude changes like we saw in 2010.
Mm-hmm. So let's get to what the players are actually dealing with. Obviously, the Magnus effect and dealing with altitude are going to be very relevant to corner kick takers and to goalkeepers. So I guess, you know, from a player, I guess a fan standpoint, what are you looking at for how players adjust to that going from playing at sea level or being conditioned to sea level in terms of the ball movement to dealing with that at altitude?
Well, they certainly have to be acclimated to playing at altitude. They've got to get used to feeling a little tired sooner, feeling a little more aches and pains in their limbs and at sea level. And they need to make that adjustment quickly because the ball is going to be flying a little faster. The goalkeepers might not object too much because the ball won't have quite as much curve on it. So they're going to have to improve the reflexes by a very tiny amount with the ball coming a little faster, but they're not going to be worried about, you know, quite as steep a bend in the curve of the ball that they would at sea level.
Mm-hmm. And then the opposite for, say, the Rapids going to play, you know, say DC United, for example, you'll be roughly at sea level. Those effects would just be in the opposite direction.
Sure. I mean, if you're used to playing at altitude, all of a sudden, maybe you're going to make a long pass to a teammate. You're going to, maybe that ball's going to be a little shorter. Your teammate's going to have to run a little less, you know, less of a sprint down the pitch to get to the ball as you know, maybe he's used to, and then hold up a little bit, wait for the ball. Corner kicks, you're going to have a little bit more bend on them, so you're going to have to play the ball out a little bit more from the goal box if you're trying to aim for a teammate for a header, that kind of thing.
Okay, let's play a little bit mad scientist here. Let's take DC United, for example, and say they've got a long road trip in MLS that they're playing at Real Salt Lake in Sandy, Utah. Say they're playing at the Rapids, and then I'm not sure how familiar you are with CONCACAF Champions League, but say effectively the North America equivalent of UEFA Champions League, mostly consisting of the top Liga MX teams. The final was Chivas de Guadalajara against Toronto FC, for example.
Okay.
So say DC United's playing, is playing Real Salt Lake, is playing the Rapids, and then has, say, a CCL game against Club America at the Azteca. And they came to you and said, Professor, you know, let's say that all the money that is needed, they have it, and they say, can you design us a soccer ball that we can train with in DC that will act the way it would normally at altitude? How would you even go about dealing with that, designing that Frankenstein ball, and what sort of ways are you looking to tweak it to make it act as it would at altitude?
So if you want to train at sea level and train for an altitude game, you'd have to train with a ball that's going to be traveling a little faster. So you'd have to do something to the ball to reduce the air drag. And the best way I could think of doing that is trying to roughen the surface even more than it already is. And you think about a golf ball with all those dimples on it. I mean, you're trying to do something to make the surface as rough as you can. I think you'd have to just, you know, if this was a bespoke ball, that, you know, they could create themselves, they would have to take the kind of panel structures that they're used to and do something to the panels to make them rougher. If you're taking an existing ball, that's a little more challenging. I mean, you'd have to put something on the ball to roughen the surface, but now you're playing with the mass and other things that the players are going to notice. I don't know that... maybe you could tell me this, I don't know the league quite as well, but are the players hunkering for this kind of technology to work with a ball that would be more getting them used to an altitude game? Or?
I haven't really asked. This is kind of a crazy thing that I thought of. The bigger complaint, at least from players more, is related to how much travel that they have to go through with it. The MLS obviously doesn't have, you know, the same amount of money that, you know, some of the other leagues have, to where, you know, the NBA and the NHL that have a lot of travel are mostly taking charters, where a lot of MLS teams are taking commercial flights from stop to stop, and sometimes there's a number of connections. So I'd say, you know, if you got together with the Players Association and asked for what they'd want to deal with travel related to playing at some of the altitude stadiums, I think, you know, affecting the actual ball would be very, very different. And usually they're able to get in a couple of days early, which, as I understand, you know, if you've got two good training sessions, say you're playing on a Saturday and you're able to train Thursday, Friday, and then a little bit in Saturday warm, usually they're able to, by the time they actually get to game day, you know, and kick off, they're able to adjust to whatever environmental conditions are playing, regardless of temperature, you know, I guess pending, you know, Houston Dynamo having to play, you know, in a snow game, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I would worry a little bit about, I know the players are very sensitive to the feel of the ball on their boot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we took the Brazuca and the Telstar 18 out to our soccer pitch and had some of our players play with them, they can tell the difference in dribbling and passing. And I don't know if you train with a ball with a significantly different surface where they got to kind of out of the feel for the dribbling and the pat, you know, what it feels like on the boot. If even though the aerodynamics more matched a game at altitude, they might suffer a little bit from not having quite the same feel of the ball when they're kicking it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there are a lot of factors that are going to make that challenging. I mean, a sport like lacrosse, we have a pretty decent lacrosse team here, and they play with a ball that's fairly smooth, but they also play with a ball that's completely roughened to reduce air drag so that it moves faster, and they're used to practicing against teams that might be really good and have a really good scorer that can, you know, shoot the ball really fast. So that's something that's just in the net. I mean, they're not, their hands aren't on it, their feet aren't on it. So, and they're manipulating a ball that's naturally smooth. You know, a soccer ball has got all the panels and the various textures and shapes and stuff. It's really hard to imagine changing that significantly so that the players think they're using the same thing on their boot, but it's behaving different aerodynamically.
Mm-hmm. In the interest of academia and us not having any funding for this, let's move on.
Sure.
So the World Cup is going on. There's been a couple of crazy games. I believe with the Sweden-Mexico game yesterday, if I'm remembering correctly, that was the sixth own goal of the tournament. That's now tied the all-time record in the 32-team iteration of it. And we're not even through to the knockout rounds. There's been a lot of goals off of set pieces. From a spectator standpoint, how are you making sense of some of what we've seen, and how much do you think the design of the Telstar and some of the physics that we saw with that is maybe playing into players not being well adjusted, and then it accidentally, you know, a defender flubbing a clearance and then it ending up in the back of his own net?
Well, that could certainly be part of it, but I mean, these things fluctuate anyway. I mean, there's always going to be a World Cup where you have, you know, the most own goals, or a World Cup where there's the fewest goals. Whether you can pin it to the bar or not, I mean, there's so many other factors involved. I mean, you know, players change from World Cup to World Cup. The altitudes change. The countries change. You know, there's so many parameters that are changing. Even the type of materials used for the pitches are, you know, changing. So I don't know that I could pin it completely on the ball. I know the players are getting the ball ahead of time to, you know, try it out. And certainly at that ultimate elite level, any little change in the ball, they're going to notice. I mean, you take a tennis racket to a professional tennis player and you change the tension by a couple pounds or something, they're going to notice that. I might not notice a 10-pound change, but, you know, they might notice a half-pound change. So there are all kinds of things that you could do to a piece of equipment that a pro would notice that an amateur may not. So they will clearly have to get used to the ball ahead of time. And it is different. But keep in mind, too, it's 4 years removed. You know, it's not like the World Cup was played last year. You know, Germany's now out of the World Cup, and people are looking, you know, I've got colleagues and friends in Germany who are moaning about the absence of the defending champion for, what, the third year in a row, I think, mm-hmm. now from the knockout stage. So you got to remember, I mean, these people, they're 4 years older. I mean, you know, they might be holding on to the veterans a little longer. Germany's young team just did really well in a recent tournament. So, you know, maybe they should have picked a few more of their younger players. So there are a lot of things that go into this. It is interesting, though, that the world's most popular sport and the world's grandest stage for that sport and the most important piece of equipment for that grand stage in that most important sport changes every time. And of course, I get asked this a lot, you know, why is the ball different every 4 years? It has to be money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Telstar 18 that I'm touching right now was $160. That's about what Brazuca cost as well. So these things fly off the shelves, and every time our new World Cup comes along, you can get a new ball with different panel shapes and designs, and the countries can name them and get different color schemes. And Adidas makes a ton of money from it.
Absolutely. Normally, as for all of my interviews with Last Word on Soccer, I typically ask for some form of prediction. You just mentioned Germany being out. Do you have a favorite at this point for the World Cup?
I picked Spain when it started. I had actually picked the Spain-Portugal game to be 3-2 Spain, and I had that one until the 88th minute when Ronaldo got his hat trick. But, I mean, I'm not, you know, any wise prognosticator in these games, so I just had a fun pick and picked Spain when it started. But they're into the, you know, the knockout round, so we'll see how they do.
Okay, then. And then we've talked a lot about physics, and then also on the sports side, you know, let's say we've got a high school junior listening to this who's on his own varsity soccer team. Maybe he just took physics this past semester, or maybe you've got a fan who's, you know, maybe 10 years removed from college, hasn't taken or thought about physics since, you know, physics 101 when they were a freshman. What sort of reading materials, or where would you have them start for learning a little bit more about some of these concepts, both in the physics sense and in the context of the sport?
Well, you were kind to mention my first book, Gold Medal Physics, Science of Sports. I do have a chapter in there on soccer physics. The thing I like to tell people who are young and thinking about careers, we don't have that many institutions in the U.S. that have, say, majors or degree programs in sports science. There are a few good ones. There are a lot more in Europe. The European countries tend to fund a lot more of that thing through the universities because the funding's a little bit out of the private hands and more on the government side. So I would certainly advertise University of Lynchburg as a place where people could come and do sports science. You know, we're doing things, projects in soccer. I like to tell my students, you want to be a part of studying the next World Cup soccer ball. I mean, you know, they can do that here. We model the Tour de France every year. We've got these new projects coming out with tennis. I've worked with students in little tiny projects before that, not quite to the prestige of these other ones, on things like lacrosse and some other little sports that we do here at the college, now university. But, I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, physics of books that are out there. You can find a physics of soccer book, I'm sure, just, you know, within seconds on Amazon or Googling it. But start with mine.
I guess on that note, traditionally, I give my guest the last word of the segment. All plugs are, no plugs are shameless, excuse me, when you're interviewing me. So you mentioned any of that. Any other closing thoughts you'd like to share that maybe we haven't touched on?
Well, I mean, if you Google me, I'm sure you can find my blog. I try to put the Tour de France stage predictions on there every year. Usually around this time, toward the end of June, I start getting email. You got to put your stage predictions up. I'm sure those people are doing so just purely for academic purposes and for no other reason. I've just recently gotten a public Facebook page up there. So I can put a link to that on the blog as well and my webpage. So I've got a new book coming out either late this year or early next year on Krav Maga physics. Mm-hmm. And it will be the same publisher, Johns Hopkins University Press. But I'm very interested in Krav Maga, and I've done some interesting filming. And, you know, we do some crazy stuff in that class. So I'm definitely excited about that book coming out later.
Excellent stuff. Professor Goff, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be on the show.